This is the current federal tax developments for the week of July the 29th, 2019. Current federal tax developments is brought to you, as always, by Kaplan Professional Education and by your State Society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers. We're going to talk this week about what we had come down in the area of federal taxes. It's been an interesting week. A few things have happened. We're going to talk about the IRS going back to a form that was last actually used back in the 1980s. We've got some final regulations on notices for certain tax-exempt organizations, and we've got a few other interesting little things to work with this year, including a potential, I should say this week, including a potential refund opportunity going all the way back to 2009 for some taxpayers, and six new compliance campaigns. So lots of different topics to look at this week. We've got a few things happening, though, coming up in continuing education, and I want to remind people here in the Phoenix area that I will be doing three courses in August. We're talking about income taxation of trusts and estates. That will include discussion of the Uniform Principal Income Act. We have a new course, Key Tax Planning Concepts and Issues. And then we also have the course on partnership and LLC taxation and advanced issues. The following week, actually the following Monday, I just finished those up, and the following Monday, I will be in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And for those of you in South Dakota, and those of you in Iowa, because both the Irish Society and the South Dakota Society are sponsoring this, we're going to have a pair of courses there that would be of interest to you. On August the 19th, we're going to have a course on preparing complex 1040s. And then on August the 20th, we'll have advanced partnership issues that feature the new partnership audit regime. That's kind of very similar to the course I'm doing the last day in Phoenix, except we're going to spend more time and have more direct concentration on dealing with the brand new partnership audit rules and how we work with those. Again, you can sign up for these courses on the website of the South Dakota Society of CPAs or the Iowa Society of CPAs. So go ahead and take a look and find, you know, whichever one you think better fits your, you know, which course might fit your interest. Those of you here in Arizona, remember the three we've got there, but, you know, we'll keep a little bit busy here in August. Well, let's talk about what actually happened this week. And the first thing that happened really was the IRS finalizing regulations that pretty much followed lockstep with what they had issued years ago as proposed regulations dealing with provision added by the Protecting Americans from Tax Hikes Act of 2015. In that particular legislation, they added a rule that an organization that's exempt from tax under 501c4, these are basically civic organizations, that they had to file a notice within 60 days after they were organized with the IRS of their intent to operate in this fashion. Now, part of the reason why that's required is because these organizations have become known for being used for not over half for political purposes, but they can have a more significant political purpose. They also do not have to file for an IRS tax exempt ruling. They can, but don't have to. So Congress decided back in 2015 that these organizations should have to file with the IRS to declare their intent. Now there's some issues with the rules. We'll talk about them here in a second. But what the IRS has done for the last few years since this was passed, shortly after the law was passed, the IRS put out Notice 2016-09 that initially delayed the due date for the first one until 60 days after the regulations were issued. Then finally we had temporary and proposed regulations issued in July of 2016 that basically were what we're going to see adopted as finals. They required the anybody who was running such an organization, organized such an organization, I should say, to notify the IRS electronically on electronic form 8976 on the website. And then they also introduced Revenue Procedure 2016-41 that contains the detailed information on how you file this notice with the IRS. Well, the final regulations, basically, we talked about the notice rule here, and we do submit it electronically. The final regs pretty much just duplicate what was in the proposed and temporary regs. So there's nothing surprising here. There were not many changes. The IRS rejected some comments, said they didn't see a reason to change things, or they didn't have the authority to change them. One particular problem we've got, though, here is that the rule does say you have to basically file this within 60 days of the date of formation, which the IRS took as the date of organization. The problem is, what if you have an organization that you create and, you know, for whatever reason, you don't originally operate it under 501c4, but then you decide later that this really should be a 501c4 organization. And you make that decision more than 60 days after you founded the organization, you formed the organization. Now you have a problem because you're already late. And the IRS agrees, under the regs, you're already late. They say that the way Congress wrote the law, they have no real authority to extend that date. And that means that, you know, you're stuck. Well, the IRS said, yes, but there is a reasonable cause exception under the law. And what some commentators had suggested was, well, why don't you just make an automatic exception if an organization had not been formed, you know, basically was not initially formed for, never operated as a C4 organization. Why don't you just do kind of a, you know, relief provision in the law? Well, Congress, the IRS said, we're not sure we have that authority, which is bad news for us, but it's the way it works. So they said, but what you can do is you file that form, you will get a penalty notice, but, you know, when you get that notice, you can just kind of call us, write us, give reasonable cause, and, you know, we probably should be able to take care of the penalty. Well, that sounds good, maybe. But the problem is, I think most of us who are involved in preparing returns would say, is that you got to first get the notice, and you got to first get a penalty notice, which is going to get in the hands of the client. That means I think most of us would consider this a less than optimal solution by the IRS, but it's the one we've got. These regulations are now final going forward. Remember, because the penalty for not filing actually gets pretty significant pretty fast. We're looking at basically, you know, the penalty if you fail to file this particular notice. We talk about this particular set of rules. Goes up to $20 per day for every day you're late and a $5,000 maximum. So, yeah, clients getting a $5,000 bill probably won't be happy. And that's what's going to happen for these organizations for the most part that start out, don't go this route, later decide to do so inside an organization that already been formed, creates issues. You might suggest to clients in a case like that, it may be simpler to just form a new organization, unless there's some real reason we got to keep the old one around, and just have the new organization apply within 60 days. We'll see how things go. But yeah, the problem with that, of course, is if the old organization actually has some assets, there can be some real problems trying to transfer to a new organization. The next thing up is a potential for a significant refund opportunity if you have the right situation. What the IRS has done on their page titled Totalization Agreements, IRS website, July 19, 2019. This was a revision. It was issued here on July the 19th. And what ended up happening there is the IRS announced that a couple of taxes they had previously treated as social taxes, which means they were basically supposed to be tied into Social Security and the Social Security agreements, and which meant they were not available for a foreign tax credit, they've decided that they now qualify. Now, I'm not going to even try to pronounce the French pronunciation of these two taxes. They are basically known by their, you know, acronym of CSG and CRDS. For those of you who are better at pronouncing French than I am, or who at least want to see what it says, you know it's the right one, we have it on the PDF we post on our website. We also have it, if you're watching the video version of this particular session, you'll see it on the slides on the screen right now as the two French taxes that are eligible for the foreign tax credit the IRS has just recently announced. Because they are considered an income style tax rather than a social tax, you're able to get a foreign tax credit. Now, why that's important is because the statute on these foreign tax credit claims for refunds actually goes back all the way to 2009. So, at least if you move quickly, we can get our refunds all the way back to 2009. That does raise an interesting question, and it's something I think we need to worry about with clients sometimes. How many of you have had clients call you and asked, how long do I need to keep my tax records? Right? Everybody wants to, you know, either you have a pack rat client who will have records all the way back to 1947, or you have these clients who, you know, don't want to be pack rats and are trying to figure out how to get rid of stuff. Well, actually, in this case, the pack rats are in better shape, because if you're a pack rat and you got records all the way back to 2009, then we're all set to file these claims for refund. If you are not a pack rat, then you may find that we just don't have information to go back the entire time frame. I would warn clients, yeah, that there are reasons why. Don't fall victim to the temptation to just say something off the cuff like, well, the IRS has 3 years to examine your return after the date of the return. So, you know, we get to April 15th of 2020. Well, that'll be, they'll basically now go back to April 15th of 2017, what was due on that one, which is 2016, so you can dump the 16, anything from 16 earlier. That's wrong for a couple of reasons, one of which is sometimes we get things like this, so you need to be aware there's a possibility it might be helpful to have that information. But secondly, you need to be very careful if there are any carryover items coming from those years. We've seen that problem, we've discussed it here before, where a carryover, you have like a net operating loss carryover that you generated back in 2016. Well, if we haven't used it up yet, we still need to keep the documentation to prove that NOL, you know, what happened. Or maybe an NOL in 17 that went back 2 years. Well, I need to show how much was absorbed in 15 and 16. That means I still need the 15 and 16 information to be able to prove that we did this properly. So be a little careful, you know, watch how they say that. You got to tell clients that what we can throw away kind of depends. And, you know, when they do decide to throw things away, there's always an outside possibility that something like this could come up where there's a change of heart by the IRS, especially on something like foreign taxes, as a really long look back period. And if you had that stuff, we're in good shape. And if you don't, well, it's not quite so good a shape, one of those problems. Let's go on to the next thing. The IRS announced a new compliance issues. The IRS announces the compliance campaigns from time to time. In this case, this week, they announced 6 brand new campaigns. These are announced by the Large Business International Division of the IRS. But they really tend to go broader than this because the small business self-employed quite often will look at these same issues and decide to expand upon them to the extent that they're relevant for their taxpayers. And some of these clearly would be relevant for taxpayers that are smaller than those normally hit by the Large Business International Division. Well, first thing they examine, which is interesting, especially for a large business part of the IRS, is they think the IRS needs to take a look at the built-in gains tax on S corporations. Remember, if you convert a C corporation to S, for 5 years after the conversion, you have to pay the built-in gains tax if you have a gain incurred during that 5-year period, and that gain ties back to appreciation that was already in place on the date you elected in. And actually, the way the law reads is different than that. You've got to prove it's not related to those things, because the law assumes all gains over that 5-year period are subject to the built-in gains tax, which will be imposed at the highest corporate rate. And that'll be imposed, and then the shareholder will still pay tax on the gain, but after reducing it by the built-in gains tax on what flows out to the shareholder. Well, the IRS believes that, you know, some people aren't aware of this tax, they're not tracking it properly. They want to go take a look at it. So that might also mean that the IRS, in order to look at that, would have to look at other S corporation issues. So if you've got an S corporation where it filed its election within the past 5 years, or at least those 5 years are still open for exam, the IRS may be targeting those to try to see what was going on in that area. Second one is also interesting. The IRS had the offshore voluntary disclosure program that let people who had accounts offshore that maybe they hadn't really reported the income on, they hadn't filed the FBARs, they hadn't filed other information. Remember, the IRS had the come in from the cold program, the OVDP. Well, the IRS now is beginning to think that maybe some of those people came in from the cold and decided that it wasn't so bad in the cold. So they may have come in, they may have paid the reduced penalties, but they may again now be not reporting all of their income or not reporting all their accounts. So the IRS wants to start up a program to kind of take a look to make sure those people are still complying. So if you have anybody who went through OVDP, don't be surprised if the IRS starts looking at them, especially if it appears their income doesn't really make sense versus what they had disclosed coming into the program and versus what you might expect they would have later. So the IRS is looking at that as a program. They're also concerned that the expatriation rules, remember now you kind of have a deemed sale on expatriation, that they're wondering for U.S. citizens and long-term residents, that's those who have been residents, lawful permanent residents in 8 of the last 15 taxable years, who then expatriated after June 17, 2008, did they actually file that final return? Did they fulfill all the responsibilities? There's concern, again, on the IRS's side, that maybe some of them aren't really doing that. There's also going to be a program looking at high-income non-filers. And the way the IRS explains this in their notice, it seems like they're concerned maybe with those offshore who have kind of stopped filing returns. Obviously, if you're offshore, but you're under the foreign earned income exclusion, and you don't have a whole lot of other income, then yeah, you know, your filing's pretty minor, it won't matter. But remember, that's not an unlimited foreign earned income exclusion. So if you're making $2 million a year in France, the U.S. does not exclude $2 million from your wages under the foreign earned income credit. Rather, you generally have to pay the tax, and you're going to take a look at using foreign tax credits to do that. Well, the IRS thinks some people may not have been filing who should be, so I'm going to take a look at that. They're also interested in bona fide residents of U.S. territories who are also filing U.S. returns and claiming refundable tax credits. You know, double dipping, shall we say. Obviously, this is aimed, you know, especially places like U.S. Virgin Islands, which is close, that could do it. You know, worried about Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands, Guam, etc., the U.S. territories, are people who are bona fide, basically, residents of the territory filing a Form 1040 and getting paid those refundable credits. Apparently, there is at least some concern at the IRS that that's happening and they need to do something to crack down on it. Finally, this one's a little more kind of out there. I understand why. Looking at Section 457 Cap A, deferred compensation payments attributable to services performed before January 1st, 2009. They're saying basically, if you take a look at that, it would be included in gross income with no substantial risk of forfeitures. I suspect the concern here is if they performed the services before 2009, the odds are that everything's vested now. There's not the risk of forfeiture. And the question being, why isn't it being properly reported? So they want to take a look at that. As always, these compliance campaigns are simply kind of announcements of where the IRS wants to focus its exam resources in the LB&I division. But it probably is going to lead into things in other divisions as well. You might want to go over with your clients who conceivably could, you know, be in these categories of, why don't we take a look at this, to understand the compliance issues and what potentially might happen in an IRS exam, and maybe consider, you know, is there anything you've done that's not right, and would you want to consider coming forward now, filing the amended return, coming forward voluntarily and filing the amended return before the IRS contacts you, generally is going to protect you from the penalties. So, you know, you might want to consider, you know, just think about whether you want to try to come in from the cold. If you do have somebody who has problems with the offshore compliance and have been following that, gang, if they're not following that now and they went into the offshore compliance programs, that begins to get us very concerned about whether or not there might be a criminal element here. I would always send that sort of person, if they turned out that they've stopped reporting again, I would definitely have a counsel, or the attorney, you know, handle that. The CPA does not want to know about their non-reporting issue right now. It's not good confession. It's not good for the soul in this case and to the CPA. Make sure they confess their sins to an attorney who has privilege, who can then maybe help them get things back in line. But yeah, that one I would have some special concerns about. Well, the IRS decided in Revenue Procedure 2019-32 that they were going to grant minor relief to some partnerships this year because of a quirk of the new centralized partnership audit regime that was added by the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015. Under the new CPAR regime, generally if a partnership files a return And once we get past the due date for filing the return, or the due date including extensions, if we went for an extension, you can't really revise the partnership return and have the partners report the revised numbers on their tax return for the year in question. Rather, we get into the administrative adjustment request regime, where you have to go in and ask the IRS, you have to go in basically and either pay the tax upfront with the, you know, based on the CPAR calculation for the imputed adjustment, and that tax is based on the highest individual rates. You can then make some adjustments if some of it's going to corporations to go to 21%. You can make some adjustments for any of that that's capital gain or qualified dividends that the individual would get at 20. You can also pull out some tax exempts, but basically you pay. So ultimately, the simplest route is pay 37% plus penalties and interest. Or you can do a push-out adjustment. But here's the catch with the push-out. Let's say we discover our partnership problem on December 1st, past the extended due date, you know, past any of those due dates on December the 1st for a calendar year 2018 return, have $100,000 of income. Well, I can push that out to the partners instead of pay the tax at 37%. But my problem if I do that is the partners do not go back and amend their 18 return. Rather, that adjustment's going to be taken into account by actually recomputing 18 in tax plus penalties and interest, but then putting that on the 19 return. So, yeah, you know, it's not the best thing in the world. Certainly seems to be a problem. And the push out has some other issues. We just got issues to work with here. But if you file a return, discover the problem before the due date or before the extended due date, if you file for the extension, you can file what's known as a superseding return. And the IRS, as they discuss, a superseding return, going back to Hager versus Kelp versus Helverling from 1940 and Revenue Ruling 78-256, if a superseding return is filed before the due date, and if you went for an extension, then the due date gets pushed back 6 months. The last return you file, basically, the last superseding return you file before that due date is considered the original return, which means that, yeah, the partners can report that. We don't have a problem if they do that. We'd like to be able to do superseding returns. Where is the problem coming in? Well, what happened if you had one of those partnerships where the partners believe that if they go on extension, the world ends and the agent shows up the next morning to audit them and they all end up in Leavenworth? We know we have clients who think that way, you know, that that's just horrible. Going on extension means you will be examined and you'll be looked at in detail. No matter how many times you tell a client that's not the case, it doesn't happen. We've all been doing this for a while, or a lot of us have. We know it doesn't happen. They still absolutely want to file before March 15th, and they absolutely don't want to ever send an extension form. Well, let's say they did that, they force that. Now you discover, especially as you get some guidance related to the changes that were made as part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, that maybe it wasn't quite right what's on the K-1, and we'd like to revise those numbers. Well, the way the law reads right now, if you did not file for an extension and you filed by March 15th, your only options go through the AAR process and either pay the tax or do the push-out adjustment, which means they got to put all this stuff on their 19 return, which to the partners will seem absurd because they haven't even done their 18 return yet. Why do I have to put this on the 19 return? Because that's what we have to do. So what the IRS has done is they've said, okay, if you did file that timely return and you didn't, you know, file an extension request, and now you find you've got a problem. Well, so long as you filed that return before this revenue procedure came out and you have an extended due date that's after 7/25/19, you have until the extended due date to file a superseding return, even if you did not originally extend the return. So we're going to give you till basically, as if you'd filed an extension, we're going to give you that period of time to file the superseding return. Now to do this, a couple of things have to be true. This doesn't apply to partnerships that opted out of CPAR, but they don't really need that. They won't get a superseding return. They'll get an amended return. But in that case, if you were eligible to and you opted out of CPAR, which again, most partnerships can't do that, but if you met all the qualifications, you filed the form, you opted out, you don't get to do a superseding, you just do the amended return. And then the other catch is you also have to have timely filed the return and issued all required K-1s on that timely filed return. If both of those are true, you file the superseding return, and assuming that, you know, we need this relief because we didn't file the extension, you put at the top of the Form 1065, superseding Form 1065 pursuant to Revenue Procedure 2019-32 on the top of the return. If you do that, you get until, as I said, what's effectively September 15th. Now, that's for a calendar year taxpayer. If you're a fiscal taxpayer, yeah, we might get a little bit extra. But basically, it's going to be somewhat limited as to what we get. Now let's talk about the last thing. This is back to the future time. For those of you who were in practice in 1982, and I actually, 1982 was the year I graduated, and therefore, I mean, I did a few extended returns from 81, but not many 1981 returns that I put my hands on. So the first really full year of tax season that I did returns for was 1982 returns. And that first year was the last time I would have seen Form 1099 NEC. Now, going back to the days when the IBM PC, not the XT, because the XT didn't come out until March of 1983. So back when the IBM PC with that, you know, with that floppy disk drive, and I'm sure there's lots of people going, of what? No, floppy disk drive, you may have missed that. It's got to be a floppy drive. But with that floppy disk drive, the floppy disk drive, the IBM PC, the clicky keyboard, that particular machine was the fancy, up-to-date, the leading-edge piece of equipment of the day. Back when that was the case and had a whopping, when initially shipped, if you didn't get that fancy floppy drive, you got a cassette deck, and the base unit had 16K, not 16 gig, please, guys, 16K of memory. And, you know, you could load it all the way up to 640K if anybody had been crazy enough to buy that much RAM, which would have been hugely expensive. Yeah, remember, that back in those days, even if Bill Gates didn't really say it, it still would not have been absurd to think, why would anybody need more than 640K? Well, today we know why we need more than 640K. We need more than 640K just to basically, you know, get the machine running these days. But those days were much simpler. And it was a much simpler time for taxes, too. The IRS released, though, today, a draft of the 1099 NEC is coming back. So we're going to get the first one since 1982. Okay. It will be used for reporting for 2020 payments. So we have one more year still putting all of this on the 1099 MIC. What we're going to do is going to take non-employee comp off of the 1099 MISC, miscellaneous, and we're going to put it onto the 1099 SEC, or NEC, I should say. And that will get it. Why are we doing this? Well, there's a couple of issues. Again, back to our good old PATH Act. In the PATH Act, the Congress added a accelerated due date for any non-employee compensation 1099 reporting. That was added as part of their attempt to combat tax return fraud. The theory being that people were filing false returns, they were creating fake income in order to maximize on the fake return the earned income credit. The IRS had no way of double checking some of this stuff because it didn't have 1099 miscellaneous. So we're now going to kick out the 1099 miscellaneous, but we had to do it by January 31st. However, all the other stuff on the 1099 miscellaneous, like rents or awards, other income, if that was always on 1099 miscellaneous, then it's not due until the old day, which would be March 31st if you were filing electronically. Well, the IRS computers can't deal with basically looking at the batch of 1099 miscellaneous that you submit and understanding that there's a different due date for when that return should have been in their hands, depending on whether or not that particular form has non-employee compensation. So that created some issues. Number one, if you were filing right, you had two batches of 1099 miscellaneous most likely. You'd file the ones that had non-employee compensation at January 31st, but you'd probably hold the others until March 31st. Why? If we discover a problem with the rents we reported or any other item, right, other income, prizes, whatever, we got the wrong number. Rather than having to send in a corrected 1099 miscellaneous to the IRS and then have the IRS with the wrong number and that create matching issues and problems for your vendors, rather than doing all that, we would just, you know, wait, see if anybody complains based on the recipient copy, because again, we still send those out at January 31st. And if nobody did, then we'd file the others in March. If somebody complained, we would modify their recipient copy, and then we would allow us to fix the one we were going to send to the IRS. Well, if you did it that way, here's the problem. If you missed a 1099 that was non-employee compensation, and now you're getting ready to file your rents and all the other things, you've got a little 1,200 1099 miscellaneous you're going to file that were not non-employee comp, but you had that one you missed for non-employee comp, so it just gets in the system and goes. That one 1099 with non-employee comp will trigger to the IRS, oh, this is a late filing, and then it will issue the penalty, not just on that one, but on the 1,200 others that aren't late. IRS said the computers can't really handle it. Well, the last time we had this form was 1982. And gang, it was a simpler time. If you're watching the video of the program on screen, I am putting, and if you don't watch the video, you can download the PDF because we've got it on there, a copy of the 1982 Form 1099 NEC, the last time this form existed. And it is a gloriously simple form. All it has on it was the name and address of the taxpayer, the taxpayer's identifying number, right? Had your name, you know, the payer's name and address, the payer's federal ID number, and the only other thing on the return was the amount that was paid. Nothing else. Very simple form. Well, the one that shows up here 38 years later is a little more complicated. Well, let's be honest, it's a lot more complicated. Has everything the old one had, but then we add a bunch of other stuff. We add a box for if you made a payment of $5,000 or more of consumer products to a buyer for resale. We have federal tax withholdings. We have a shaded out box 3 that could be used for something else later. We also have state information, state tax withheld, state ID number, and state income related from this 1099 SEC, along with the account number. So it's a lot more, let's say it's a form that's got a lot busier than the 2012 prior version of the form. Remember, this form is not going to be used for 2019 payments. It's going to be used for 2020 payments. The draft went up on July 24th. You can take a look at it. Your software probably will start coming up with the difference between this and the other one for next year. You may need to change some coding in your system depending on how your software works. But you should be aware that coming up in 2020, we're going to have this brand new 1099 NEC, a form last issued by the IRS in the Reagan era. So it's been a while. Remember, it is that time of year. Check your state society's website for the courses they're offering now. Get registered for your 2019 CPE. It really helps everybody, you know, helps us. As long if we know earlier that you're going to go ahead and be at the course, that helps the state plan properly for the course. That helps us know that, hey, there's going to be enough, everybody showing up. You know, we can get everything in place, because obviously if nobody's going to show up, you know, if there's absolutely nobody signed up for the course, there's no point in holding a course. So it is kind of helpful to know that, yeah, we got a lot of people coming. We need to be ready for that. We can get those that can help keep the costs down, to be totally honest. So, yeah, registering is helpful. And the other thing to remember is that this is a complex year. And your CPE right now, your 2019 CPE, getting some live courses in there, setting them up to come in later in the year and we get some more guidance, or right now, there's things happening constantly. And it'll be really helpful for you, you know, especially in areas you do a lot of work in, to go take a course and see what the status is of areas that are important to you today with a live course. This is not the greatest time to be using a lot of self-study that was updated, you know, back in October last, because some things may have changed. Things change shortly after you finish doing courses. As I said, I did a partnership course here to begin the week, and later in the week we get this CPAR special rule that we can, you know, do these, you know, we do superseding returns, and you know, I was just a few days after the course is over. So, you know, it's kind of useful to know things are happening. And yeah, keep tuning in here. We'll try to keep you updated on things that happen here as well. This has been Current Federal Tax Developments, for brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education, your state societies of CPAs. We do post our regular updates online at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle there is at Ed Zollers. You can also send questions and comments to me. My email address, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. As I mention every week, I follow discussion groups online. I follow the Connect sites for the state societies I'm a member of. That includes Arizona, Minnesota, and New Jersey. So you can see some stuff there. If you have some questions, you can post to their discussion groups. And I'll try to, if I see it and I think I can add to the conversation, I will try to post. I also take a look from time to time at the Tax Talk site from Cal CPA. Any CPA anywhere in the country, go there. You got to go to groups.yahoo.com/tax talk. You then apply to get in. You have to have a Yahoo account. You have to ask for permission to get in, because only EAs and attorneys, I should say only CPAs and attorneys, are allowed into the group under its terms, but you do not have to be a Cal CPA member to come into the group. And you can then have discussions there based on, you know, tax issues. It's what it probably, I think it is without question, the most active tax discussion group I know of on the web. And finally, you can also go into the Reddit group for Tax Pros. This one is not going to be as active as Tax Talk, but there are regular posts there. There are issues. Some things get discussed. Software gets discussed there quite a bit. And that's r/taxpros. And as I've said before, they do a really good job of getting rid of the people coming in looking for free advice. The state society sites and Tax Talk don't have that problem because they pretty much cut it off at the front end. But, you know, when you get to Reddit, they do a very good job of telling people who aren't tax pros that they should probably go to the R Taxes site instead of the R Tax Pros site. So we get that there. Well, we got another week coming up. Who knows what's coming out? We still got lots of regulations on various TCJA issues, both final and proposed, that need to be issued. We certainly will have other court cases and other items happening. So be sure to join us next week for Current Federal Tax Developments.